is Radio Freethinker, episode 67.
And welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
And this is not Rob. Rob will not be here for this episode or for the next couple. We'll have to get along without him. But I am Daniel, president of the UBC Freethinkers Club and economics student here at UBC.
And obviously social secretary for Rob to inform all the people about why he'll be missing his appointments this week.
Well, someone had to.
That's right. Someone had to. So did you guys have a productive and skeptical week?
Yes. I had a busy week catching up on some schoolwork, getting all my stuff packed. Unlike Rob, I don't have a social secretary to announce that I won't be here for the next couple of episodes because I'm going back to my birth town, Brandon, Manitoba, for a few weeks to see what it's like to have a real summer. Anyone who's grown up in the prairies know that Vancouver doesn't really get summers. It just gets hints of summer. 40 degrees above, sun all the time, and rain. Oh, when it rains on the prairies, that's wonderful. It's like being pelted with rocks from the sky.
Well, did you guys see the rain in Vancouver yesterday? Wow, that was pretty crazy for a couple minutes.
Yeah, it was intense. Well, I actually had really good news over the weekend because I learned that the Constellation Project is not quite dead.
Constellation Project? Is that something to zodiac signs or something to do with what?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, Don, that kind of rambling question, because the Constellation Project is the project that NASA had prior to its redirection a couple of months ago to send space explorers to the moon, possibly Mars, and to have a very active presence in space. Now, a long time ago, we talked on this show about space exploration and about NASA's new direction, which is, frankly, not terribly exciting. A lot of planning and not quite too much going to space.
Where did they suddenly get the money to keep it going?
Well, they didn't, actually. They sort of kind of, well, we're going to do it anyway. It's that old, you know, keep trying attitude. Well, actually, it turns out that despite Obama's new directive, NASA and Congress as well are quite skeptical of how NASA is going to continue to function with such a small budget. And we've talked before about how there's a lot of congressmen who have some deep ties to NASA.
Isn't this one of the things that it sort of harkens back to the Cold War, is that the United States has to have its own independent means to get into space, and NASA's plan in the short run, anyhow, is to rely on private entrepreneurs to create rockets to replace the shuttle when their shuttle retires later this year. And that some people are getting a little nervous saying, well, maybe the free market won't be there, or even if it is there, maybe it'll pull a BP or something.
Not only that, they're also relying on other nations to get them to space, like the Russians or the European Space Agency, which is not exactly rubbing NASA the right way. Now, the thing is, and their point is, well, look, we've already spent about 10 billion dollars on the Constellation project. And if you cancel it now, all that money is wasted. So, I mean, that's a lot of money. So after a recent meeting in a town that I can only imagine was named after some space sci-fi plays called Galveston, NASA is considering how they could get to Mars on an extremely limited budget.
You're being funny there, right?
No, that's really the name of the town.
Galveston.
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 Not Galveston. It's actually quite a big place.
Well, I like Galveston. But
we quibble.
The plans include in-orbit refueling stations and a nuclear-powered ion engine for space exploration.
That sounds pretty awesome.
It does sound pretty awesome. There's also plans to continue the Orion crew capsule, which would have been canceled with Constellation, but will now be just be slimmed down. And the Orion capsule would be a transit shuttle for getting astronauts to and through the International Space Station. Now, what this all is going to come up with, building the technology before you actually have a mission statement remains to be seen. But I think it's a good thing that NASA's not just going to be sort of sitting around for the next five, eight years.
I imagine there are a few people in the private industry who are a little annoyed because usually when the government drops technology, it doesn't actually drop it. It just says, okay, people can become private contractors and vote and do whatever you want. And a lot of government technology becomes private technology that way. But
here's my thinking with what they're doing. It might be getting a little political, so I won't go on it long. But I think they're just expecting to get more money because enough senators in the U.S. will say that it'll get jobs into their state and they'll just bypass the president and just get it put through Congress. But I don't think they'd be doing this unless they are pretty sure they're getting more money.
Yeah. I mean, after all, it's a lot of money to fund space exploration. So where they would get it remains to be seen, unless they, you know, dramatically scaled back their military budget or something. I mean, it'd be a bad idea.
Maybe they're thinking that they'll be getting a bit of a kickback from BP, you know, sort of, sorry about ruining the Gulf. Here's a couple of billion. Let's just pretend nothing happened.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you sort of imagine how difficult it is capping like an oil spill in the bottom of the ocean. Imagine if you had a nuclear-powered engine break down in low Earth orbit.
You just call the little green men.
I guess so.
I hear they do good repair jobs.
Yeah. Well, that's NASA's news. What's going on in the rest of the world?
Well, in something a little more complicated. That was a horrible joke. A bunch of researchers at the University of Arizona have cracked the key to making money in the stock market.
Well, are we allowed to talk about this? Because they're the ones that passed that immigration law, right? I thought there was a boycott and everything to do with Arizona. Or are we, for the sake of science, going beyond that?
I kind of doubt the specific scientists who did this actually support that law. But so I'm just going to continue. Basically, what they did is they decided that it'd be a good thing, or in order to predict short-term fluctuations in stock prices, they should look at news stories. The theory behind this sort of it comes down to the basic problem in determining what stock prices are going to be, and the people who do this fit into a few different groups. There's the fundamental analysts who basically look at the long-term profitability of a company. They go, well, they're in a market that's going to expand, and they're the leader in that market, so how much money they can make is likely going to expand into the future. They look at the companies and the markets they're in, whereas others, known as technical analysis, basically look at trends and sort of the emotion behind stocks. Their basic thing is that people aren't very rational. They follow the trends. They follow the herd. And so if a stock price has, for the most part, been going up, well, chances are it's going to keep going up. And that's sort of how they do it. What this AI does is it's sort of a mixture of the two.
AI. So you're referring to artificial intelligence, a computer program.
Yeah. They use the term AI. I probably should have air quoted that or something. It's basically a computer program. It's not all that sentient or smart like you might think of AI. But
it's not going to make me coffee in the morning, or
it'll make you money to buy coffee.
will it be able to drive Constellation spaceships? We digress. So tell me, what is this AI going to do?
So what this AI does is it looks at news stories for stocks. And it looks for keywords in it. It doesn't fully analyze everything in the news, but it looks for keywords. And it's created sort of an algorithm that picks out certain words and putting all the words together determines whether a stock price is going to go up or down because of those words. If the program determines that the stock will move up or down 1% within 20 minutes, yes, just within 20 minutes, that's all it focuses on, it will either buy the stock for 20 minutes max, or it'll short the stock, which basically just means it's a way to make money off of a stock going down. So it only does this for 20 minutes max. It will never hold a stock longer than that. And it's been very successful. They haven't actually really run it with lots of actual money, but in simulations, it's been very successful.
They're using Monopoly money, is that what they're doing?
So this is in the idealized world they've created. I'm curious about one thing.
Not an idealized world. It's based off of the real world stock prices.
Yeah, most idealized worlds are based on the real world. That's why they're idealized. So it only holds stock for 20 minutes at a time, and it uses sort of news information. I assume you mean business, not real news, but business information.
Could use real news, but yes.
But I know we live in the 24-hour news cycle, but I mean, that seems like there's going to be a lot, it needs a lot of new news in order to make new purchases, that this 20-minute window will quickly absorb all the news available to buy anything.
Yeah, it doesn't constantly buy things. It wants to be sure that the price is going to go up or down a percent within that 20 minutes. So the basic reason this works is that regular human traders are going to take longer than, let's say, 10 minutes in order to ingest a news article and then determine what the stock will do with that. So for that window, this thing can trade at either a lower or higher price than the stock will likely be once humans catch on to the latest news. So basically, it exploits the slowness of humans. And also, it also sort of exploits the fact that humans act irrationally to new stories, especially if they're emotionally charged. So if a story comes out saying, like, oh, there was a small disaster at a mine for some company, chances are the stock will go down more than it really deserves to based off of the fundamentals, and this will profit from that.
So basically, this is working off of the story I think we did last week about how people are irrational, but they're irrational in somewhat of a predictable way, and that this algorithm, this program, is taking advantage of the fact that although people don't behave rationally, we know usually how they will behave irrationally, and we can use that to make these short-term purchases.
Exactly. And just to give you an idea of how well this is working, in its tests, it beat the market by 3%, which is a lot. If that's compounded annually, that's a huge amount. And it beat mutual funds that traded in the same stocks by 2%. And just for some interest, I'm going to go through the top five words that add value to stocks and the five worst words.
So everyone get your pens ready. This is going to make you millions of dollars.
I don't know about that, but some of them are kind of funny. The top five words that increase the value of stocks in news articles are planted, announcing, because everyone loves when new things are announced, front, not sure why, maybe because they're the front of the pack, smaller, and crude. So crude, I guess, oil, maybe. But the worst five are kind of even more interesting. Here too, I'm not sure how that would lower the value of a stock, but apparently it does. Comparable, because you don't want to be, like, you don't want a stock that can compare to something. You want something that's just completely unique. Charge, who knows? Summit, because obviously you can only go down from a summit. And interestingly, most interesting, green. Putting, if a company has any news about how green it is, apparently the stock goes down.
Well, that's interesting. I suppose you could come up with a whole list of psychological reasons why that would affect AI.
I'm quite sure. Of course, I'm stunned that these guys would print this off. You think they just create this machine, keep it to themselves, and then open up a trading house and make millions of dollars.
Well, for all you know, they're keeping out a lot of important stuff.
Like, or like maybe they reverse the order of those words.
Yeah, see, exactly. Maybe they're trying to like play with the market so people start using these words and they really know that they don't actually do what they say here.
Well, why don't we go to a commercial break and our listeners can go and try these out for themselves after listening to Radio Freethinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. Now, we're going to be talking a bit about autism. Now, let's make a pact that we're not going to mention the M word.
Not knowing what M word you're thinking about, but we won't mention it.
Right.
But first of all, we're not going to mention the V word either, because this is a test for autism, or supposedly. The headlines, which I think are quite interesting.
Geneticists?
No, actually, it says genetic finding. Anyhow.
poorly worded title.
So basically, it says that some Canadian genetic scientists are leading the way in revealing the genetic architecture of autism, revealing brand new targets for treatment, and making possible predictions for DNA testing at birth. Or at least that's what the first line says. When you read down a bit more, it says that they've done studies with 1,500 families, 120 researchers, 11 countries, and out of that, 10% of them they've identified with genetic markers that's caused brain abnormalities. And they said, ha-ha, there we go, we've got a testable thing. And I mean, that sounds good, right? I mean, you know, there's some moral questions about if you could test your child before it's born, to see whether it was going to have autism or not. Would you want to know that? Would you be aborted? Would that be a form of eugenics, that's the word I'm looking for. But if you read a bit more into it and you get past the headlines, out of that, only 10% of them, like I say, had that. No two seem to have had the same genetic marker. And they actually make a point here that they said that it's almost impossible to make any kind of generalization about this genetics.
Is that, I guess, lead into the explanation of why autism is actually a spectrum and not a single disorder, that it's not predictable in that regards. It's a widespread, multifaceted condition.
Exactly. And I mean, the bizarre thing is from the headlines, and there's a couple of them in the newspaper, make it seem like genetic testing for autism is it's here, we can do it. And they actually make reference that there's been a number of companies phoning up these researchers saying, hey, we have these little kits, you know, you put a swab in an envelope, you mail it to the company, and they'll do a genetic test. We want to start doing autism tests and all. And the guy says, no. One of the researchers, whose name escapes me at the moment, I think it's Dr. Shriver. It's so bizarre because, I mean, the one thing they've said is that, well, actually, there is no genetic link here. You know, there's a lot of things that can cause it, but the whole article just keeps pushing this, we've got a cure. It's just one of those things where newspapers seem to take a little bit of truth, stretch it really, really wide. Although there is another interesting aspect to this. It was also part of an announcement of $8 million being spent by the Ontario government to further this genetic research.
So the goal here is to examine, I believe there was something like a couple thousand kids who had autism in Ontario that they want to test to see what genetic markers they have that contribute to their autism. Because like you were saying, it's not one little code part of their DNA that, you know, switches on or off that causes the autism. It's a wide range of genetic problems that result in autism.
I think the best analogy is the idea of cancer, right? Mm-hmm. Autistic spectrum disorder is a big blanket name for a lot of different things that just have similar symptoms, right?
Right.
It was an interesting look at how science and news often separates on it. Now, the fact they're spending more money into this is interesting because, like cancer, right? Even if it's only 1% of those 10% that had a genetic marker, if there is something there that they can actually start working with, then, I mean, that's a valid thing, right?
The thing, though, is if it's a genetic thing, if they're probably... I don't want to say it here because that sounds crude, but that seems kind of what some people are aiming at this being, but really, wouldn't it only be at most a screening process? Well,
that's what I kind of got from the article. I mean, I don't see how they can fix anything at this stage except for what they were kind of hinting at, the sort of Planned Parenthood type stuff of like, oh, listen, you know, Mr. So-and-so, your kid's going to have 85% chance of developing this type of autism. Do you want to proceed with the pregnancy? Which is what they were kind of cautiously hinting at.
Well, and you also get the idea of the Gattaca syndrome, right?
Yeah.
Where you're going to have autism later in life, so we're going to put you down this stream, which is probably not valid.
And again, because of the variety of autism, you can have everything from severely severe autism to high-functioning autism. And I don't know how well this was able to predict the difference between high-functioning and severity, but I think that's kind of a big leap to suggest that this is going to lead to sort of a, like you said, a Gattaca-type situation.
Well, another thing, too, that I don't remember seeing in the article, and I couldn't find the research that this article is based on, so I might be missing something here. But so they've identified a few genetic markers, right, that seem to be in some of these. But are those markers present in people who don't have autism? You know, I mean, like is this, we found them here, and therefore this must cause autism, or could they, maybe we have them, and it hasn't affected us because it isn't the actual cause. It's either corollary or just part of the...
So they didn't really compare it too much to, like, people who don't have any sort of spectrum of autism, their genetics?
Right. All they know is that certain parts of these things, like, for example, there are missing chromosomes that some of these children had. And they believe, from other studies, that if you miss this chromosome, then you miss part, your brain doesn't develop properly. Now, again, they know these genetic things can cause brain deformities. They found them in the children. But, I don't know, it seemed to be a bit of a...
It certainly seems like a study that could lead to interesting things, but yeah, the stuff that the newspapers and stuff have been saying is nothing to do with the actual outcomes.
I think one of the ways it can lead to a treatment besides screening is if some of these genetic abnormalities are the lack of protein being produced or something, then you could supply that to people. I mean, there is some possibility for doing that kind of thing. And there's always been the promise of future of genetic modification. You know, there's a study, there's a science about that, but I can't remember where they put viruses into you, and it actually changes just parts of your genetic makeup to alleviate some genetic defects that people may have.
Well, if we ever get that far, it could be a possible solution to the autism problem. Now, why don't we go to commercial break? And when we come back, we'll reveal to the listener why we played The Clash at the start of the show.
Dum-da-da-dum.
Are you a UBC student taking first-year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring? That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa! How does it work?
It's on a first-come, first-served basis, and there's no need to sign up. Just show up with your books and your questions.
Whoa! When does it happen?
Monday to Thursday from 3 to 7 at the Sub Pacific Spirit Cafeteria, located beside the Starbucks.
Whoa! A+, here I come.
What might one hear when listening to an episode of Mondo Trash Show with Maxwell Maxwell on CITR 101.9 FM?
I love you so much, Madonna.
Sundays at 9 o'clock in the evening.
And that's why I'm gonna kill you.
Sundays at 9 o'clock in the evening.
Muscle, and oh god, it's so beautiful.
I'm calling the police now!
Hey, I'm Maxwell Maxwell, and every Sunday at 9 p.m. on CITR, I play electro and indie rock, and I give away free concert tickets, and you should totally listen, because it's pretty cool.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Now, we played The Clash to start the show out. Why on earth did we do that?
We played The Clash, Rock the Casbah, which was kind of big in its day. It was dealing with Middle East and tensions and conflicts and all that that are involved in the Middle East. And today we thought we would tackle an interesting area of political skepticism. Recently, there was in the news about how the Toronto Pride Committee has denied a group called QAIA, Q-A-I-A, Queers Against Israeli Apartheid. Yes, it's okay if we use it, that word, to participate in the Pride Parade. TPC was forced to do this because of intensive pressure and legal intimidation by what some have called hawkish Israeli lobbyists and a threat of funding cuts from the Toronto City Council. Those who are against Israel's treatment of non-Jews in Israel or the Palestine and occupied territories claim Israel's an apartheid state. Those who support the official Israeli line condemn those who use the term apartheid as being anti-Semitic and misusing the term to both denigrate and vilify, quote-unquote, the Jew.
So how can we apply skepticism to this problem?
Well, the way that I was thinking about it, There is on one side the idea that you cannot use the word apartheid, that it's inadmissible and it's only used as a form of propaganda. So I wanted to look at that and I wanted to say, well, can you apply the word, you know, apartheid? Is it a valid, if not sound, argument? Valid mean logical, sound? It's up to you to decide whether it's true or not.
And does it have, like, a definitive meaning? If it's... the only reason someone could logically say apartheid is a word you shouldn't be saying is if it has no real meaning, like it means like just pure insult, but there is a meaning behind it.
Fortunately enough, or unfortunately, if you happen to be in someone from South Africa, the UN codified in the 70s, and it's been updated since then, what it is to be the crime of apartheid in an international convention on the suppression and punishment of the crime of apartheid. It actually codified, I said, this is what qualifies as it. And it's divided into five parts, and any one of these would qualify as apartheid. One, denial of a racial group of life or liberty by the use of harm, physical or psychological, arbitrary arrest, or the denial of freedoms or dignities. Two, deliberate imposition on a racial group, living conditions designed to physically destroy the group in whole or in part. So ghettos would be a good example of that kind of thing. Legislative measures intended to deny a racial group political, economic, or social participation in their country and deliberately preventing that group's full development. This includes things like the denial of the right to leave or return, the denial of the right of freedom of movement, among others. Any legislative measure intended to divide the population along racial lines, isolating racial groups into separate geographical enclaves, prohibit legal marriage between racial groups, the expropriation of land belonging to one group for the use of another, and five, persecution of groups or organizations that deny the rights by denying them their rights because of their opposition to apartheid.
So I just have a question now. Does that have to be on the books, part of the legal system of that country, or can it also be sort of an unspoken, unwritten rule of the land, the way sort of Jim Crow era was in the South of America?
Okay, well, Jim Crow was laws, but yeah, no.
Well, they weren't like, yes, that's a complicated issue, but no, you know what I mean.
But you are right. These here have to be government-type acts. So that's why people refer to the Southern United States as segregated and not apartheid, because although they were divided based on color, it was not exclusively, but many times it was an implicit thing, like vagrancy laws. Mm-hmm. Vagrancy laws in the law apply to everyone equally. It was just white cops would apply them discriminately towards black people.
But if the outcome of a law is clearly fits the definition of apartheid, why should it matter if the actual written word of the law isn't?
Well, again, I think for the sake of this argument, the idea is that you want to get rid of the idea that I'm using this strictly as a term, a propaganda term, that there's actually something there. And one of the ways that someone can criticize is say, listen, technically it's not an apartheid state because it's not legally done in law. So that's why there is a niddling distinction. Morally, you could probably still use it. But again, for the idea of political skepticism, or the point we're trying to do here, we're going to follow the rules.
So,
and we can expand from that. Like I say, in the end, we'll see where it sits. But what is this a valid argument to make?
So then, does Israel fit that description you just gave us?
Well, the first thing we really need to do when we look at this is there are two areas that come into this. One is they make constant reference to the idea of racial group. So you need to establish a racial group. Another thing they also mention is that it has to be done by your own country. So if England came to Canada and did sorts of bad stuff to us, it wouldn't technically qualify because the British weren't doing it to British citizens, they were doing it to Canadian citizens. So that means one of the things that's taken out of this right away is the West Bank and Gaza Strip, because those are occupied territories. They're not actually part of Israel proper. Although, of course, those people who want to annex those territories get their way, then it does. And the evidence, if you include those areas, becomes very overwhelmingly in favor of the idea of apartheid. But for the moment, we're limited to just Israel proper. So we're going, so how do you, is it a racial group? I mean, how do you determine a racial group? So I went to the Israeli website itself, and I went to check out a few things. Now, they have two laws in there that I think point to the whole idea of this being a racial group as part of that. The one is the law of return, which was huge for Israel in the early days, because basically it says, hey, if Jewish ancestry, that's their term, anywhere in the world, you can come back here if you want. Right? So by their own definitions, they're defining what it is to be Jewish and by extension Israeli, because with this law, once you've returned to Israel, you automatically gain Israeli citizenship as a racial group and not a religious group. So in that aspect, the law of return implies that Jewishness, at least in Israel, is seen as more than just a religion, but it's seen as a racial group. Unlike someone, let's say, the United States. Everyone says, well, the United States is a Christian country. Israel says it's a Jewish country. Well, the United States, the term Christian is not limited to any particular race. It's seen as a religion. In Israel, that's a much more foggier line.
So you can't, if you lived in France and were a Christian, you can't just move to America and de facto become an American citizen because you're Christian.
Right. But if you're of Jewish ancestry, you can. Now, there have been some court cases that are beginning to challenge this. Right, but the law has been this way since I think 54 is when it originally came into law, but it's been there for a while. Now, on top of that, you also have another law, which is the citizenship. Let me make this right: citizenship and entry into Israel law. Now, this one basically says that if you're an Israeli citizen, you cannot bring in your wife into this country if they haven't come from the Gaza, the West Bank, and a few other Arab countries. If you're an Israeli Jew, you can bring it in from anywhere, right? Now, this is one of those things, it's in law, it's like the Jim Crow laws type thing, right? It applies to all Israelis equally, but there are very few Jewish people living in the West Bank or Gaza Strip, and very few in Egypt and all that. So this law that prevents you from reuniting your family or being married to someone there disproportionately affects Arabs far more than it does Jews. And that leads to another interesting law that they have, which really dumbfounded me when I heard this, is Israeli's marriage law. Did you know it is illegal for you, Ethan, to marry Daniel if you were a Jew and he was a Christian? They don't have gay marriages there either. But in theory, that's not the thing that blocks it. It's the fact that you're not allowed to marry outside of your religious group. So a Shiite or a Muslim can marry a Muslim, a Christian can marry a Christian, a Jew can marry a Jew, but never show the tween.
What if you're an atheist? Are you only allowed to marry atheists?
Well, actually, and that's where again, it becomes a very sticky thing. Because if you are an atheist, right, you can't get a rabbi to marry you. Or I guess you might get a priest to marry you. Who knows?
But a rabbi will marry a... like a Christian?
Nope.
Okay.
No, it's strictly divided on religious lines. And each, there's different, I don't want to call them schools, but there's different associations that authenticate Jewish marriages, authenticate Christian marriages. But this marriage, it's illegal in Israel to be married to anyone outside of your faith. Now, there's one way to get around this, is if you're married anywhere in the world, and this would include you guys being gay, okay, if you were. If you get married anywhere in the world, Israel recognizes that marriage. So you can come there even if, you know, they'll recognize your marriage even if it's not legal to actually have had that marriage done in Israel.
What if it's a polygamous marriage?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Well, I guess it's a topic for another show. If it's recognized somewhere else in the world, I guess in a way they would have to allow it. But no, so again, you know, strongly seems that you can make at least the case that Israel sees itself as a people as opposed to more than just a religion. In fact, I was having a discussion with someone saying that Israel is no more a Jewish country than France is a French country, as in, you know, they are the people of that country. And the marriage law seems to go directly against one of the laws there. Now, you add, in contrast to the law of return, there's another one called prevention of infiltration law, which...
That just sounds bad.
Well, and it strictly prohibits Palestinians and Arabs from re-entering Israel. So you have the law of return on one hand, saying if you're a Jew, you can go to Israel, no problem. And another law saying that if you're an Arab, you're not allowed to come here ever. So again, it seems to be making... This case. They also have another thing, which I go into in my blog, but I'm probably not going to go too much into here, with the land issues, about ownership of land. There's a thing there called the Jewish National Fund, which is a nonprofit, but it's responsible for setting up Jewish settlements and purchasing Jewish lands. And it strictly holds that it will only sell land to other Jews. And it was taken to the Supreme Court of Israel. The Supreme Court of Israel said, listen, that's racist. Can't do that. So you have to sell it to anyone who's willing to buy it. So the Israeli Land Authority, which is sort of their National Parks Board type thing, it's a government institution, circumvented the judicial agreement by saying, okay, you, the JNF, the Jewish National Fund, if you have to sell land to an Arab, we will give you government land in compensation for that. So the amount of land owned by Jews will always be the same, or will never become less than. It can increase because they can buy more land, but it'll never decrease.
But they'll never do that because Arabs can't get in the country in the first place.
Well, but that's the thing. There are Arabs in the country right now, but 20% of the population are Israeli Arabs.
Right? So if they leave, they can't get back in.
Well... Yeah, well, that's not the way it works, because they're Israeli citizens, and once they're Israeli citizens, they can come and go. But they can't immigrate to the land. They can't go into Israel, right?
So this is complicated.
By their laws, they couldn't bring their families if they lived in Palestine?
Well, yeah. So, for example, if you happen to be an Israeli Arab, and you go and you marry someone in the West Bank, and you cannot bring your wife or your husband, or your children, into Israel. There's even actually, and this gets really crazy, is that even if you're a Jew, sometimes they won't let you do it, because if you're not Jewish enough, they won't let spouses gain citizenship. That's the crux here, right? I mean, I'm sure that Israel is a very vibrant tourist industry. It's not saying, no, you can't come at all. But if you come to live, and the prevention of infiltration law, which is the one that prevents Palestinians and Arabs from coming to that, that's strictly based on the idea of the right to return. Now, when Israel took over its land, that's probably too strong of a term, but when it became the State of Israel, there was huge immigration. Then there was the war, 48 war, there were a few other wars after that, where people were forced to leave, or strongly, you know, pressured to leave. And that's where you had a huge exodus out of Israel of Arabs, right? Now, of course, things have calmed down. They want to come back to their homeland. I mean, they've been living there for generations, generations, and they say, well, I should be able to go back there because it is my homeland as much as it is anyone's. And this law says, no, you can't, not allowed to. If Jewish, sure, no problem, right? But if you're not Jewish, then you're not allowed to. So let's go back to where we were doing this. So we do seem to have some elements here. Now, of course, Israel, at least in Israel proper, isn't killing Arabs, right? And there are some people who suffer a certain amount of discrimination, but that's people on people and not state. Israel is, by and large, in its own country, much better when it comes to human rights for its own citizens. Not great, but better. For example, one of the Knesset members, which is their parliament, was involved in the flotilla that went in, and we may talk about later. She's being threatened of having her citizenship stripped because she was involved in this flotilla, and that's one of the things that they can do because if they don't like it, they can strip your citizenship. It does seem that on many of the cases, Israel is clean, right? It doesn't kill its people. If you count the Gaza and West Bank, you could say they're physically trying to destroy it, but they don't do it in Israel. But the idea of the right to return, the right of movement, and the idea of racial segregation at least makes it a plausible argument, which is ultimately where we're going here, which goes back to the original thing about the Toronto Pride Committee not allowing this group in there because it's being accused of being a racist group, of using the term apartheid inappropriately. Now, you may or may not believe Israel is an apartheid state. That is a debatable issue, but that's sort of the whole point. It is a debatable issue. You're not a ramping racist for calling Israel an apartheid state. There are justifiable reasons for making that claim. There are also justifiable cases for saying, well, it doesn't quite hold. Although I do find it interesting, and this is secondhand, so I have to be careful about this, but I've been told that actually South Africa officially labels Israel an apartheid state. So if anyone knows what an apartheid state is, you think South Africa would be the one.
Maybe they're just trying to get some attention off of their history.
Who knows?
Shift it on someone else.
With the World Cup going on and all that.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a complicated issue. It sounds like there are issues about free speech, about
freedom of movement.
Freedom of movement, and also I think concerns here that open discourse is being prevented by special interest groups, which is always, I think, unfortunate, even if the group in question, the what were they called again?
The Quaya. Quaya against Israeli apartheid.
Even if they're completely wrong, having a debate with them, I think, or discussing the issue, as opposed to just shutting them out, kind of does a disservice here.
Well, and I know, and a lot of the people who are criticizing this group are equating them with Holocaust deniers, which, again, is just, it's an outrageous comparison.
It's a complete ad hominem attack.
Yeah. Well, it's also irrelevant. I mean, we're talking about Israel here. We're not bringing up the past. We're talking about a set of, like Don gave us, a set of requirements that this state has to meet to be an apartheid state. And if all those requirements are completely off the board, then they're completely wrong. But as you said, some of them are there, some of them aren't. It's clearly a contentious issue, and it looks like you can have a reasonable debate on it without resulting to banning somebody from marching in a parade.
Well, and the city council threatening to pull $4 million of financial support for the Pride Parade,
right,
if they didn't do this. Which, of course, just shows you, I mean, there are very strong lobby groups that are at play, and they can have a huge influence. We were talking earlier about Ann Coulter and how the big fuss about that held. And there are people who will use the idea of discrimination for their own political advantage. And, I mean, again, part of me doesn't blame them for raising the flag. It's just how quickly people succumb to it. So you have these people who are supporting Israel's case. And again, I don't want to shut them up either. They have just as much right. This is not a open and closed case. It is a debatable issue. And they should have a right to say what they're saying. But in their defense of saying, listen, you know, we want to stop discrimination, so we want to discriminate against these people, just strikes me as a form of circular logic that's in name.
Right, well, why don't we go to a commercial break and we'll be back with some more contentious issues on Radio Free Thinker.
Why, sometimes I'd like to take a peppermint and a switchblade and a Cadillac and throw it all in a fire.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio for crazy people and the elderly. Oh, yeah.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. We're talking about contentious issues.
And now we'll go to something that's perhaps a little less contentious, or not. Recently, there was a flotilla of humanitarian aid that was being sent from Turkey to the Gaza Strip. And it was prevented from doing that by the Israeli naval forces. Now, of course, there's a lot of things that are at play here. When you see what has gone on the TV and YouTube and that kind of thing, the Israeli Defense Force, the IDF, has put out a lot of videos, edited videos, that basically show things to be in one particular way. There have been some blowback the other way of saying, you know, Israel attacked and killed defenseless individuals. The other side says, hey, this is an illegal occupation. We really need to do something about this. So I thought, again, this might be an interesting case where we can use the idea of political skepticism. How can we, you know, where is the propaganda and where are the issues, and then start discussing the issues. The first question I thought I'd ask myself was, there's a blockade on the Gaza Strip. Is there any justification for that? And does Israel have a right to blockade? So I thought I'd do a little look into that. Now, of course, from the Gaza Strip, there have been a lot of mortar attacks, about roughly 8,600 rocket and mortar attacks. Now, rocket attacks can go quite a big distance into Israel. Basically, any part of southern Israel can be hit by a rocket attack. Mortars are really short-range weapons, can't go that far. Now, they've fired a lot of them. But, of course, out of that, they've only killed about 28 people. So they're not very effective weapons. But
they do instill a lot of fear.
They do instill a lot of fear. There is this sort of sense, you know, at any moment it can go. So, again, we may have issues of proportionality, right? I mean, you know, Israel has killed a hell of a lot more Palestinians than have ever been killed by these rockets. But still, these rockets are coming. That does seem to be a valid threat.
And it's not so much Israel. It's not so much the damage they've caused. It's still an attack, nonetheless.
Right. So the first question: Can Israel justify blockade? Okay, yes, it can. I'm still not saying that it should blockade, but there is at least a rational reason for them blockading.
The argument I've heard from people who support Israel on this point is: imagine people close to Canada had rockets and mortars and were firing into our city. Let's say Vancouver was under not constant rocket barrage, but the chance that a rocket could hit anywhere in Vancouver anytime. Wouldn't we want to step in and do something?
Although a more appropriate analogy, which has been brought up by other people, is imagine if you were in occupied Poland with the Germans occupying the land and there were constant rockets or whatever going into Germany. Would that be, you know? So I understand what you're saying, but there is the point that the Gaza Strip is considered to be a hostile territory. It is an occupied area. But you're right, but there is an existential threat. I can understand why the Israeli government, in the idea of trying to protect its people, would want to stop these. And one way to do it is to try and blockade, to prevent arms from getting into the Gaza Strip. Well, that said, where can they blockade? Well, obviously, the lands are easy, right? You just put up a wall on the borders. But naval blockades are a bit more trickier than that. Because a naval blockade, technically, is only supposed to be in territorial waters. Now, some analysts say, well, no, there's historical precedent, say you can blockade anywhere in the world. If you know that ship is going to hostile, quote-unquote, territory, you can blockade it anywhere. But technically, according to the United Nations Conventions on the... Where is it? Nope, that's the wrong one.
The UN has a convention on blockading?
Yeah, actually.
They have a convention on everything.
Wow.
Yeah, there are laws that cover everything in the world.
Wow. Well, so moving on then, what is...
I found it.
Oh.
The San Remo Manual on International Law Applicable to Armed Conflicts at Sea. Which, again, in there it says technically it needs to be territorial or conflict waters, right? So you can blockade enemy waters, you can blockade your own waters. So in that sense, right, where this blockade can be, is very important, where the incident actually happened. Because the incident happened in international waters. It happened 70 kilometers off, where technically 22 kilometers is what international boundaries are. And of course, there's also the other issue about what is justified to be blockaded. I mean, I think if you're going to blockade a place, arms, munitions of any form, very valid. Band-aids, medical supplies, not valid.
I think their argument would be, though, they have no way to determine what's on the boat unless they can get on it in the first place, which is exactly what they eventually did.
And they never did actually find any real weapons on there.
Although no, they did but find their them. Argument would be that there could have been, and that boat was just trying to cruise straight through their blockade.
Right. But one of the things, though, that adds this is Turkey pre-inspected the boats beforehand, right? Because you're right, that's a valid concern. Who knows what's going to be on the ship? So Turkey said, and Turkey's been a longstanding ally of Israel, right? It's been one of the few Arab countries that have always sort of been on the same side of Israel, said, we went over the ship. There's no contraband on it. It's a safe bet. You don't have to worry about it. But that obviously wasn't quite good. And another thing that goes into this is some of the things that are not allowed on there. There's some things that are, quote-unquote, deemed as luxury goods, such as paper, crayons, tomato paste, lentils, canned juice, among other things. And these are also blockaded items. Some items that are blockaded, which is really a contentious issue, things like cement, which... The Israeli Defense Government says they don't want in there because it will allow the bad people, whoever that might be, to build reinforced bunkers or whatever in Gaza. The Gaza people said, listen, we've been bombed constantly for 5 years at least, and we have no more buildings. We need to rebuild. We have no place to actually literally live. So one of the big contentions is this whole idea of building supplies. Now, of course, even if they are building reinforced bunkers, they don't throw concrete in the rockets. The rockets don't actually have concrete in them. Maybe they will in the future. So there's a huge contentious issue as to what qualifies as humanitarian aid, right? So this ship was full of, again, according to Turkey, vetted humanitarian aid. Israel said, even offered, hey, bring it to us and we will redistribute it for you, right? Just land the ships in an Israeli port and we'll do it. And on the surface, that sounds valid. But as I mentioned before, what Israel considers to be humanitarian aid and what it considers to be luxury goods and stuff are quite questionable at best. So the flotilla group says, listen, we'll go there and we'd give you the stuff, but you're not going to distribute it. You're going to either keep it. There was one instance where they had, I think it was shoes or clothes, that Israel, through paperwork and that, kept in storage for, I think it was 5 years. And by the time it was finally given over to the Palestinians, it was moth-eaten and they were unusable. So this face-saving measure that Israel said, hey, we'll distribute for you, wasn't really a valid option for the people doing the flotilla, above and beyond whatever political statement they have. So ultimately, it comes down to, like I say, where did this happen? And there was another incident that had occurred a few years ago called the Spirit of Humanity, which was a previous attempt to try and break this naval blockade. Now, it was stopped about 20 some odd kilometers off the coast, which is close to territorial waters. And it was a peaceful incident. The boat was redirected. Not much had happened. So when this particular event occurred, the one in question we're talking about specifically is the Mavi Mari, which I'm hopefully not butchering too much, where the Israelis, depending on your account, attacked and then tried to board. And the people on board tried to defend their ship because 64 kilometers out is international waters and technically piracy. So that's how they did it. Of course, the Israelis say, hey, we were just enforcing our legal right to blockade. But like I say, there is cases on both sides that make it seem, what's the word? You can, Israel can do its blockade, and you can say that's quite valid. The people trying to break the blockade, again, seems to be a valid argument to make. I think, me personally, the part where it breaks down is where it happened. It happened in international waters. I think the people who were on board the Mari Mavra had every right to defend themselves. And although the IDF has had some very interesting edited videos that were put out there, if you've seen that, and some that they've actually had to retract because they edited them and added audio, such as, why don't you guys bugger off and go back to Auschwitz or something? That was put in by the IDF to make these people look like horrible things. I mean, the propaganda that has been spun out of this has been atrocious. So again, I guess ultimately I think it was a very bad thing that the Israeli government done. Using the idea of the political skepticism to part away the propaganda, because there's propaganda on both sides. The people who were doing the flotilla wanted to have a political incident. I mean, in many ways, in a horrible way, the deaths that had occurred on the ship were kind of a godsend for the cause, because of one, it created some martyrs, not religious martyrs, but genuine martyrs. That's another video that they have out going on there, that there's a bunch of jihadist al-Qaeda types. Again, they've had to retract these that were on board. But they wanted to make a big stink about this. They wanted to bring the world's attention, and I think they have succeeded in doing that. Conversely, the IDF wanted to put out a bunch of propaganda saying, listen, we were helpless individuals. Our soldiers landed on the ship, and they were attacked by these raving bands of insane people, and going, no, that's not true either.
It seems to me that the argument by the IDF is sort of the similar argument you will get in a lot of police brutality cases, where the police will hit someone first, and then that person naturally is going to fight back. They're not just going to let themselves get beat. Whether the police officer was going to continue doing anything really bad, who knows? But then after that part, after them fighting back at least a little bit, now the police officer uses that as a justification for what many would argue is excessive force. And it seems to me sort of the same with the IDF, where they boarded the ship like with military helicopters, military boats everywhere. These people could very well have feared for their life. And so fighting back with clubs and stuff like they did, I hardly see that as unjustified.
It is important to note that there was one person killed before they boarded the ship from gunfire. Maybe it was missed gunfire, but they were harassing them beforehand.
Well, I guess my question that I'm going to raise, and I don't mean to sound crass or crude about this, but if the humanitarian people knew they were sailing into a bee's nest, why'd they do it?
Well, I mean, first of all, this had been done before, right? This wasn't the first flotilla attempt, but it was the first attempt that had the Israelis firing live ammo. And again, the other side, and I'm going to call this propaganda for the moment because there's no corroborating evidence for it yet, but there were people who were shot in the back of the head. There were people shot in the back. So I don't think they were expecting this kind of violence to happen. They didn't want them to board at this point because they didn't think they were close enough. It was like it's like a police officer who's used to kicking the bum around town, right? And if he just lets them do it, then it doesn't seem to be an issue. They're overreach, I guess, is the word I'm looking for. So I think that's why they resisted when they did. They said, listen, you know, if we were in your territorial waters, sure, no problem. We're not going to do anything. But from their point of view, you shot at us, you threw stun grenades at us, and now you're trying to board us in international waters. No, we're not going to put up with this. We're going to at least attempt to defend ourselves.
But my question is, though, like, I'm sure they knew to a certain degree that they weren't going to have an easy time about this. Why wouldn't they have thought of a different way of getting humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip then?
Well, there isn't. That's the thing. I mean, obviously they're not going to fly a plane in, because if they did that to a ship, and in previous attempts, you know, they've rammed ships, right? And that was one of the things that they were worried about. Because if you look at the videos, both sides of the videos, everyone who was on the flotilla were wearing life jackets, because they were more likely, if violence was going to occur, they had assumed they would try and sink the ships and you'd need to all get off. That's why everyone was on top, right? They were expecting trouble. They weren't expecting armed troops to come in and start shooting people. Mm-hmm. That took them by surprise. So they wanted to do this. They wanted to make their statement, right? They wanted to bring attention to the blockade. And they knew there would be trouble, but no one knew it would be this kind of trouble. Like, so they were prepared. They knew crap was going to hit the fan, but they didn't think that the Israeli government would go so far as to start killing them.
Well, contentious issues, and I hope that our listeners will write in and let us know what their thoughts are. And they can do that at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. We're out of time for today, so let's jump to our skeptical highlights real quick. I have two. CFI has a lecture entitled Science and Medicine Under Attack, Why Religion and Politics is Dangerous. That's Friday, June 25th at 7 p.m. at SFU Harbor Center in room 1600. And it's a talk by Dale Jackman, one of, if not the first, openly atheist politicians in Canada. The other event is to let people know that tickets are now on sale for the CFI lecture by world-renowned astrophysicist Lawrence Krauss, entitled A Universe from Nothing. And you can purchase tickets online at www.cficanada.ca/Vancouver. Krauss will be speaking here at UBC on July 3rd, and there'll be a reception afterwards, so be sure to register for that as well.
It's really easy to get your tickets. There's no excuse not to.
There really isn't.
And for all those people in Brandon, Manitoba, or Winnipeg, I will be in the neighborhood, so if anyone wants a speaker or any talks on skepticism, atheism, political skepticism, what have you, just contact us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com, and we can arrange for talks. I'm sure the other people will be available for that sort of thing locally, even.
Yeah, I'm sure if you can afford Don's speaking fees.
And on June 21st, which is next Monday, the UBC Freethinkers are having a barbecue at Jericho Beach. It'll start at 6 p.m. You're encouraged to bring your own things to drink and to eat and grill. There might be some extra stuff, but it's best to bring your own. And come out. It should be a good time with lots of good local skeptics.
Excellent. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying good night.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Daniel saying thanks for listening.